More than half of the world's languages are at risk of dying out over the next century. On this week's edition of Please Explain, we'll look into what causes languages to disappear and the efforts being made to document and revive the most endangered ones around the world. Joining us now are Dr. Gregory Anderson, director of the Living Tongues Institute for Endangered Languages, and Anthony Woodbury, professor of linguistics at the University of Texas. Hello and welcome to our show.
Hi, thanks.
Nice to be here.
Greg, approximately how many languages are there around the world, and what percentage of them can be considered endangered?
That's a good question. The exact number is difficult to pinpoint. Roughly between 6,000 and 7,000 is the number that we work with, and about half are considered to be endangered, generally speaking, by most linguists, although some people have different criteria and push it higher or lower than that.
Has the rate been faster in the past few decades or slowed down because people have been concerned?
I'm not sure you can really quantify it that way. There are a large number of languages which are right at the very brink of extinction, and that process hasn't changed that much in the last 60 or 70 years maybe, but you know, there's a lot more awareness about it, so perhaps people feel the urgency more, and that's certainly we've seen that there's a trend towards doing something about it in some communities at least.
Tony Woodbury, what does it mean for a language to be endangered?
Well, it can mean a number of things. It can mean basically it means that the language is falling out of use, and that's something that could happen very abruptly, or it's something that can happen over a longer period of time. And it also doesn't necessarily depend on the size of the community. There can be a community with a million speakers that is very endangered and another with 600 that's not endangered at all.
And are the causes fairly similar, or usually a dominant language in the area that most of the younger people start speaking?
Well, there always will be a dominant language, but the causes are many and various. They can be social and political. They can have to do with migration. They can have to do with encroachments from outside. They can involve natural disasters. There can be really any number of factors, and it's always partly a decision that's taken locally as well as something that's imposed from outside. So it actually has many aspects to it.
Well, why should we care that these languages are disappearing? Does it really matter if so few people speak them?
Well, the first question is, what do you mean we? So we includes people who are speakers of these languages. And at the same time, people who aren't speakers of endangered languages may have an interest in hearing other languages and knowing about other languages and what other languages bring to our broader knowledge of the world and our broader humanity, our broader sense of linguistic aesthetics, of poetry, and any number of different kinds of aesthetic considerations that come from languages. So it's a really quite wide question. On the other hand, many people don't care, and it doesn't matter to many people.
Including some of the people whose language it would be if
Indeed,
they decided
absolutely.
To speak it. Greg Anderson, are there certain parts of the world where languages are disappearing more rapidly?
Average level of endangerment is definitely more severe in certain places of the world. A large portion of the New World would fall into that category. Not all of North, Central, and South America, but many parts of those various countries, you find moderate to severe endangerment across many of the, if not all of the languages in a country or a region. In other parts of the world, you find endangerment as well, although the sort of average level of severity is more in the you know, becoming endangered or moderately endangered, as opposed to really at the tail end of its existence with only a handful of elderly speakers. So that would be what you'd find, you know, more or less across the Asia, Southeast Asia, Pacific, African areas is moderate to mild, if you will, levels of average levels of endangerment across a given region. That's not to say that there aren't many numbers in total numbers of endangered languages in those areas, because there are. But in terms of how soon they're likely to disappear, in many parts of North America, for example, they're already gone. And there's only heritage recordings that exist that, and in some cases not even those, that could help to revitalize should the community desire that, because these things go in cycles, and often there is a desire, even if there isn't at one point or another in the community's history, that desire often comes back, and if there's no documentation, then of course it can be nothing but a fantasy. But if there is, then there's the possibility that something could be done about it. But so, you know, in the U.S. and Canada, certainly parts of Brazil, Bolivia, Argentina, you know, you're looking at severe levels of endangerment on average for most of the languages that survive, and many have already disappeared.
When did languages start being documented and studied around the world? I'm assuming it started before recording devices were even invented.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a difficult question to answer precisely. The Akkadians taught Sumerian as a language back, you know, more than 2000 BC or something. Sumerian was already sort of out, but existed as a literary language when the Akkadians replaced the Sumerians in that part of Mesopotamia. And so in a very real sense, they were, you know, teaching and having recorded Sumerian language for the purposes of, you know, ritual or whatever. So, I mean, the process goes back many years. There are various people that you might pinpoint as sort of innovating the process of documenting various parts of the language of the world. There was a guy that took part in the circumnavigation with Magellan, for example. I believe he was Italian, who recorded numerous parts of basically word lists and a little bit of the grammar from various South American and Asian languages. So, you know, he in a very real sense could be identified as sort of the first scientifically interested scholar who was systematically collecting and trying to describe languages. But, you know, the process goes hand in hand with the colonial process throughout Latin America. They often were interested in having the Bible translated into some particular local vernacular that would serve as a means of converting the population. So this has happened throughout Western expansion from Europe out into the rest of the world, certainly hand in hand with that particular colonial process. Systematic linguistic investigation probably happened in the 19th century sometime. Tony might know some more about that.
Well, first of all, I should tell my listeners that my guests are Dr. Gregory Anderson, director of the Living Tongues Institute for Endangered Languages, and Anthony Woodbury, professor of linguistics at the University of Texas. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Did the field of linguistics develop to some degree because of these kinds of concerns, or did the people in linguistics just become involved out of some kind of natural interest?
I think linguistics is usually comes out of anthropology, if I'm not mistaken, but Tony probably can answer this, please.
Tony, you're the professor of linguistics.
All right. Certainly in the United States, the task of documenting the indigenous languages of North America was really front and center and drove the development of linguistics in the 19th and 20th century. Linguistics dealt more widely with the nature of language, and so the documentation of the world's linguistic diversity is just one part of that. But you could say quite fairly that, especially in the first part of the 20th century in the United States, that was really the main project of linguistics and linguistic anthropology.
Well, what's involved in documenting a language? How's it done? Most of these, I assume, don't have their own alphabets.
Right. So one of the early steps for most of us as a practicality is to create a writing system, to develop a way to systematically represent the sounds of the language so that you can keep track of what you're doing. But documentation actually can be thought of more broadly as a way of creating records that will be cipherable, that will be understandable to philologists and heritage speakers 500 years from now. So you could, for example, document a language by making a bunch of recordings, creating very careful translations of those recordings into a language of wider communication, so English, Spanish, Russian, or whatever, and then hold that as a sound archive. And if you've done a little bit of basic work just trying to figure out what the sound system is and performing the kinds of tests you need to figure that out, you basically could send something forward pretty much in a sound form. It's a slightly controversial idea, but in principle, it's something that you could do.
Are there endangered languages where there are no speakers that also speak another language to translate or serve as a guide to the language?
Absolutely. And
so how does documentation happen in those cases?
Well, I'll give you an example. A student of ours, Lev Michael, found himself in that situation in Peru a couple of years ago, and he lived with people who are referred to as the Nanti, and basically learned their language from them. So he learned their language by the way over, you know, centuries and centuries, people have always done this. He basically watched people, pointed to things, and eventually developed competence on his own. And from there, he created a description, and as a sort of semi-speaker himself, and developed a grammar of the language.
Greg, do you find much activism in communities with an endangered language? Are non-speakers interested in saving their traditional language?
I'd say that's the primary impetus of what's going on in most communities in North America today, and in parts of South America as well. These are people who've identified their language as a particularly important feature of their identity and have acknowledged that this has been essentially taken from them or their ancestors chose to no longer use it for a variety of social factors, largely, that are not desirable ones. They were not decisions taken lightly. They were decisions that were essentially forced by necessity. So they feel this loss acutely, and I think that's a large portion of language activists in many communities around the world, really, today. Some communities you find the language slightly more intact, and therefore you have people who are speakers or semi-speakers who are watching the process, you know, unfold, where the speakers are becoming older and older. The young people are not using the language. They're only using the contact or dominant language. And, you know, so they take that decision to devote action and energy to helping maintain or promote the language while it still has a speaker base that's sufficiently large. In other areas, that speaker base is eroded to the point where there's only a few semi-speakers or no speakers whatsoever, and there you're dealing with a very difficult but still possible process of revitalization.
Because in some cases you have one person who's very elderly, and when that person dies, the last speaker in the language will have died. But I'm assuming also there are synthesis languages being developed, kind of like Spanglish, where you have a dominant language and an endangered language being used together. Is that not happening?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So there are examples, for example, of Quechua and Spanish in Peru as a kind of fusional language that is in quite wide use and involves elements of both, for sure.
Well, Tony, you recorded a language, Chatino, is it?
Mm-hmm, that's right.
From South and Central America.
Yes,
how many people still speak it?
Chatino has about 30,000 speakers. So it's not endangered. Chatino itself is a language family, though, with a number of different languages within it, like just the way Romance contains Spanish, Italian, French, and so on.
So the one you recorded, the Zacatepec Chatino, that's the one that is endangered?
That one is very seriously endangered.
Should we listen to a little bit of it?
Speakers. Sure.
Well, Well, does that sound like other languages that we know?
You tell me. What does it sound like to you?
Well, it doesn't. I mean, it sounds like a language,
but I'm
not exactly sure. There's a little Chinese to me. And,
all right. Okay. Very good. That's what I wanted you to say. It's a tone language, and Chinese is known. Mandarin mm-hmm. Chinese has four tones, so there are four different tones that distinguish words from each other. In this language, there are 12 tones.
Well, Cantonese is 7 tones, so we're moving up the scale.
We're moving up the scale. And so it is typologically, it has some features similar to Southeast Asian languages, but, you know, it's its own thing. It's an American language.
We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we'll listen to some other endangered languages and take your calls. Our number here is 212-433-9692. That's 212-433-WNYC. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. And my guests are Anthony Woodbury, professor of linguistics at the University of Texas, and Dr. Gregory Anderson, director of the Living Tongues Institute for Endangered Languages. We're talking about endangered languages on today's Please Explain. We're back with Dr. Gregory Anderson, director of the Living Tongues Institute for Endangered Languages, and Professor Anthony Woodbury, professor of linguistics at the University of Texas. We're talking about endangered languages on Please Explain today, and we invite your calls at 212-433-9692. A couple more questions before I get to some of those calls. When a language is being revived, is it taught as a written language as well as a spoken language? Greg?
That sort of is determined by the desire of the community. Most communities would be found in literate cultures and therefore probably want a written form as well. However, returning it to some kind of conversational status used by people in daily interaction is often a goal. So probably both is the right answer.
Tony, is part of a linguist's job to advocate on behalf of a language, to convince a community that it is important to save their native tongue? Is there resistance?
It's our responsibility to be able to give an idea of the broader context of what's happening, but I absolutely don't think that it's our job to push people into directions that they weren't headed already. In my experience, though, you find that once linguistic issues get brought out into the open, a lot of enthusiasm that wasn't initially evident becomes evident. So people find it actually amazingly revealing to hear that there's an interest around the world in their language, that their language isn't a kind of incoherent dialect that isn't as good as Spanish or isn't as good as English. And so when you bring out these issues, they connect very much with what people know at a kind of deeper level about their language, that it is a thing of beauty. And so I think that often leads to a sort of changing of hearts.
Do they generally fall into certain kinds of structural patterns?
Absolutely. So that's what we as linguists are all about. That's what we really love. We really like to go in and figure out what those patterns are and to be able to make them explicit. So there's a scientific value in that as well as a practical value.
Well, how much do they tell us about the people who are speaking the language? For example, what we heard before, there was sounded kind of Chinese. Would that suggest that there's a Chinese link? Because Native Americans did supposedly came over the Bering Strait and settled America, but probably way before Chinese developed as a language.
Right. That actually was an idea that had some currency a long time ago. The Athabaskan languages, which include Navajo, have a little bit of tone, and it was thought that they might be related to Chinese. But it turns out that tone is one of these things that comes and goes, that is easily developed and easily lost. And we now see that there are independent origins for the tones of the languages of Southeast Asia and those of of the Americas. So that not that particular feature isn't one of them. But there are other things that do suggest broader historical connections. There are certain grammatical features, for example, which mysteriously manifest themselves around the entire Pacific, around the edge of the entire Pacific, and suggest very early patterns of spread.
Let's take a call. Karen from Edison, New Jersey is on the air. Hi, Karen.
Hi. I'm calling to find out about Native American languages, how many survived, how many are gone. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, and I'll just go ahead and sign off and listen to your answer. Thank you.
All right. Greg, do you have any statistics on the top of your head?
Well, there's, I think, roughly about 150 languages still with some one or more native speakers in the U.S., although many of those, the number is very small, so closer to one than any kind of number that would make you think that the language has a long-term, long-living speaker base. How many have disappeared is also pretty hard to answer, but, you can probably guess it's somewhere between 100 and 300 languages just in America alone have disappeared since initial contact with Europe. So, the situation, I can give you some specific data on here in Oregon. Oregon was at one point one of the most linguistically diverse places in the entire world. At the time of white contact, there was 14 different language families spoken in Oregon, some of which have been united into these big families like Penutian, but they are discernible families on the sort of level of romance that was brought up earlier. So,
would they be related to the languages that the Inuit speak?
There are no languages related to that, but there are Athabaskan languages, which Tony mentioned earlier, and several other ones which occur only here. Today in Oregon, 2009, there are only five of those 14 language families still remain. So nine have disappeared, and they have no more speakers. And this is a travesty and part of the loss of the intellectual heritage of Oregon as a state. And that's something that many people here who are born and raised in Oregon are unaware of and shocked when they learn about how diverse Oregon. It's still pretty diverse, but compared to what it used to be, is it's a shock, really.
We have a clip of a recording Michael Krauss made in 1961 of Anna Nelson Harry, one of the last speakers of Ayak. And the recording was published by the Alaska Native Language Center, University of Alaska, along with a book called The Art of Anna Nelson Hayek. Maybe we can listen to a little of it and compare it with some of the other languages we might hear. Now, of course, that sounded a bit like Chinese to me, too, but with clicking. There are clicking languages all over the world, aren't they? Are they all disappearing?
Okay, there's let's define two different kinds of clicking. What you're hearing in that recording are sounds that are glottalized sounds, like kla or ga, like that. But those are not click sounds like you find in some of the languages of southern Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's...
You mean like Xhosa?
Yeah, exactly, right. Very good. And so basically, this is a type of sound that can develop anywhere, really, but is very, very, very widespread along the entire North Pacific coast. So what you hear there is not tone, but you hear a kind of lilting, repetitive pitch that goes with these very, very kind of long phrases and silences alternating. And that's stylistically very, very characteristic of the whole Northwest coast. So you have a kind of a mixture of culture and language that are embodied in these little performances that we have clips of.
A listener, Tina from New York, asks, the Manchurian language she's heard has only 50 people speaking it now. Is that the case? And is anything being done about that?
I can comment a little bit on that.
Greg?
There are two languages in China that claim to be the successor of Manchurian proper.
Ethnically speaking, there are, you know, millions, if not 10 million people who identify as Manchu, but as a spoken language, one of those is definitely down to roughly that, several dozen speakers, more or less in a single village, a single community, although there are a couple of other outliers that probably have speakers. So the other one is pretty far away, actually, in another part of China, which was a garrison of some sort or some kind of Manchu army outpost that had managed to preserve another set of speakers up till modern times. So it is true that Manchu is either way, no matter how you slice it, even if one has a few thousand versus, you know, under 100, you're still talking in China a severely endangered language that's unlikely to have more than one generation left of speakers. And Chinese language ideology is pretty strongly non-welcoming to other minority languages. The ones that are really, really small tend to pretty much just assimilate fairly quickly.
As a matter of government policy, after all, there were many dialects throughout China, but Mao kind of forced Mandarin on everybody, didn't he?
Well, that's true, too, but there's the minority policy is somewhat perverse in China. They have 55 recognized minority groups and certainly more than 55 minority languages. So by definition, people get amalgamated for administrative or whatever you want to call it convenience into separate ethnic groups, which are defined more or less culturally as they differ from mainstream Han Chinese versus linguistically. So I think there was an article in Nature or Science or Scientific American or something relatively recently about some Yi languages, the Yi minority. It's actually multiple languages. I mean, most people who are specialists in this area were aware of this, but somehow this seemed to be a great revelation that the Yi nationality spoke multiple languages. It's true of virtually every southern Chinese group and several of the northern ones as well. So Chinese language policy is somewhat odd because of Chinese ethnic policy is somewhat odd, but that means that certain languages are enfranchised and likely to survive, and other ones are, by definition, disenfranchised, and the environment for them is much more hostile.
I think that caller Ted from Manhattan has a question along these lines. Hi, Ted.
Yeah. Of course, without going into it, the Chinese policy is actually recently in certain areas to stop teaching subjects in language, in the native language.
It's not surprising.
One of the forces of the unrest.
Ted, do you have a question?
Yeah, I do.
Go ahead.
You've spoken about the adverse circumstances, but there have been, in effect, linguistic and policies in the United States. There was the boarding school.
Mm-hmm. And not just here, Canada and Australia. This has been government policy throughout the world, hasn't it, to assimilate people, supposedly as an idealistic thing?
Right.
Go ahead. Either you want to respond to that?
Well, just absolutely. You know, it's true that there has been a tremendous amount of engineering on the part of the government about language, and that this has had an effect, that people talk about being sent to boarding schools, being taken from their families, being sent a long ways away, being punished if they uttered a word in their own languages. So it's not in a vacuum that a lot of this has happened in the Americas, at any rate.
Let's take another call. We have Bill from, what is it, Wall, New Jersey?
Wall, New Jersey.
Hi, Bill.
Hi, how are you? I just actually returned from living in Ireland for the last 5 years. It's great to have the Leonard Lopate show again in the right time zone. Two quick questions. I guess one, living in Ireland and watching the cultural politics of language preservation, I guess Ireland is an interesting case study for government attempts to wipe out a native language and then kind of nationalist attempts to revive it. And I'd wonder what your views were on the Irish language and Irish language policy. And then the second question, I guess, what your views are on the status of, I was fascinated to learn that there were so many smaller languages in the British Isles, Cornish and Manx, Breton in northern France, which was a Celtic language, and how, you know, how that fits into the discussion.
Thanks for calling. Gentlemen, either of you want to take that?
Yeah, that's a complex issue, Ireland. You know, there's both successes and failures of the policy of both the assimilation and the revitalization policy. So I'm not expert in Irish politics and the use of Irish language and the current 2009 assessment of the usefulness of the teaching of Irish in schools and whatnot and the presence in the media. So someone who's expert in that, which there must be many people, would probably be better to answer that.
We've gotten a number of calls from people who are curious about Yiddish and Ladino, which were languages that were created at a certain point, fusion languages, and now are not spoken as much as they were in the past. Are they real languages?
Oh, absolutely, sure. And they're distinct and very different from the languages that were their primary sources, so German in the case of Yiddish and Spanish in the case of Ladino. So, they're good examples of languages that grew up in different cultural environments and that became different enough that they, can reasonably be spoken of as different languages.
We have a caller from a listener from Pennsylvania who left a question on our show page and asked, does high density of many languages in a small area lead to or predict the collective death of all of these languages, a case in point being India?
No.
Wow. Yeah. I'll just tell you a little experience that I had. Last February, I was visiting at Australian National University, and my host, Nick Evans, took me with him to his field site on Croker Island in northern Australia. It's in the very, very northern tip of Australia. And this island, which has about 400 people on it, is a place where six different languages are spoken. And of those six languages, several of them are only spoken on Croker Island, and most of them are spoken just by older people there. So it's a situation where linguistic diversity of a very, very high level has persisted to the very end.
Are the languages very different?
Yes, they are. Some of them are actually fairly similar, but some of them are actually very, very different, like German versus French, that level of difference.
So that's what fascinates me the most, that languages that are very different can coexist within the same area.
Yeah, I was just returned a few days ago from a long trip to Papua New Guinea, which is the mother lode of language density
yes.
and diversity. And in some areas of New Guinea, one of the areas we've spent time in, you could go, if you went 20 miles from where we were in every direction, you would cross three or four different languages, and in several instances, completely different unrelated languages, which have no common ancestor in any sense. So as different from each other structurally as English and Chinese.
Because they would develop when people were living in total isolation from each other.
Well, that's part of it, yeah. And the social dynamics are such that multilingualism is more common than one language having to always accommodate to the other, which is where you find language endangerment, is when one group has to speak the language of the other group.
We have to leave it there, unfortunately. Thank you both so much, Dr. Gregory Anderson. And Dr. Anthony Woodbury, we've been talking about endangered languages on today's Please Explain. It's been a real pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
On Monday's show, we kick off our two-day series, Legislative Leftovers, by looking at what remains to be done on health care reform. Then our latest underappreciated book series with a look at the writer Yousef Idris. Also, Stephen Healy on his book, How I Became a Famous Novelist, plus a panel discussion about writing crime novels about New York City. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Drew Katchen and Adam Delahanty. Jason Isaac was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We will see you next week.